Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming. It's with great happiness and excitement that we begin our new share, a new series of classes on the Kuzari. Looks like it's going to be a very intriguing and exciting class with Rabbi Karapkin. So without further ado, I'd like to call and invite Rabbi Karapkin. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Rabbi Wolf and Chaki Abisera, thank you very much for the honor of speaking. The lecture topic for the next 6 weeks is the Kuzari and the antecedents to Hasidic thought. What we're going to try and do over the next 6 weeks is to get a thumbnail sketch, a broad overview of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, his unique thought, and specifically the work called the Kuzari. It's a daunting task, but we'll try our best. If I can give a shameless plug, those of you who are interested in studying the Kuzari in more depth, Feldheim Publishers recently came out with a revised translation of my work on the Kuzari, called The Kuzari by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, with my translation and commentary, and it's got Hebrew and English on the same page, and it's, in my opinion, an excellent way to be able to study the Sefer. What I'm going to do tonight is to give you the historical context of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, just give you a little bit of the history and his unique worldview, and we're really where he's coming from in the context of the broader scope of medieval Jewish thought, medieval Jewish philosophy. I'm going to assume, for the purposes of this audience, that some people here may not know very much about this particular period of time, which is the 12th century, and the way that people were thinking during this time. So I apologize if I am providing you with information that is already obvious to you, but so please bear with me as we get further and further into this discussion. I want you to join me on this tour of Jewish history as we travel to the southern part of Spain in the 12th century, which is called Andalusia, is its Islamic name. Now, Islam as a religion took off like wildfire ever since it began in the 7th century. It began, as we know, in the Arabian Peninsula and spread throughout the Middle East and finally made its way all the way into different sections of Europe. And it actually, at one point in history, threatened to take over the entire European continent until it was finally quashed sometime in the 13th or 14th century. Now, during this period of time, which is the 12th century, we are at a time when Islam is quite dominant, it's quite popular, and it doesn't begin in Europe. It begins, as I mentioned, in the Middle East. The center of Jewish thought and Jewish leadership before it migrated to Spain actually started in Baghdad before it during the Gaonic period in the 9th and 10th centuries. And eventually, sometime in the 10th century, the seat of power switched so that the last of the Gaonim, which are the leaders that are coming from Babel, ceased to exist sometime in the late 9th, early 10th century. And Jews and the seat of Jewish power migrates into Spain. I'm going to get back to the 10th century in just a second when I tell you the story of Chasda ibn Shaprut, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. During this period of time, the Jews go through what is known as in world history as the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry. Now, why was it known as the Golden Age? It's called the Golden Age because this was a time when, relatively speaking, when we talk about the medieval period, Jews were able to enjoy a great degree of religious tolerance, the ability to practice their religion freely, to study Torah, and to do mitzvahs without much harassment and persecution. I should point out, however, that were we to try to relate to modern-day religious freedom, it probably would not be perceived by us as a time of great freedom and a great time of religious expression, because everything is relative. So there was still this thing called the dhimmi status, where Jews living in an Islamic under an Islamic government were still considered to be second-class citizens, and as long as you didn't insult Islam, you were allowed to practice your own religion. But there still wasn't complete free speech the way we have it today. But with that in mind, we understand that this is a time of great expression of Jewish religion and the ability to spread your wings. Now, any time we go through a period in history where there is an opportunity for Jews to do religiously what they please, there is also the opportunity for Jews to integrate within the general society. So people have an opportunity to take government jobs, and so therefore we find a lot of Jews being involved with the government and being physicians and being really able to integrate freely. That is a blessing, as you can imagine, but sometimes it's also a curse. The curse that we've seen in the last couple of centuries is quite apparent. At any time there is an opening of the doors of the ghetto, the Jew has this opportunity to exchange ideas freely, and sometimes the ideas of the outside world can potentially be dangerous and damaging to the Jewish society, the Jewish community. So there's a reformation that takes place in the 19th century as a result of the breaking of the walls of the ghetto. There is nothing like this that we see happening until the 19th century. However, were we to try and trace what's going on in the 12th and 13th centuries in Spain, it's very clear that there's a much more open exchange of ideas between the Jewish community and the great thinkers of the Jewish world and the Islamic parent culture that is the host to this Jewish world. We can really trace the beginning to Rabbi Sadia Gaon, who lives in the early 10th century. And the first work that we find where Torah is examined through a prism of a certain kind of thought that is popularized by Islam is in Rabbi Sadia Gaon's very famous sefer, Emunot Videot, Emunos Videos, a book of faith and a book of understanding is one of the ways to translate the sefer. There was a very popular way of explaining religion and specifically the Islamic faith that was going on at this time. It's important for us to realize that when we look at the Islamic world today, we see a world of religious fundamentalism and even religious fanaticism. And it would be a mistake for us to superimpose that image going all the way back to the 12th century. This is a time when sometimes history does flip-flops, and you look at the Christian world and you look at the Islamic world going back then, going back to the 10th and 11th and 12th centuries, and you discover an Islamic world which is quite rational in its approach to religion. So much so that there is a large amount of integration of philosophy within the explanation of the Islamic faith. What I mean by philosophy, and this is quite important, when we talk about philosophy in the medieval period, we are specifically referring to primarily Aristotelianism. Now, Aristotle lived much, much before this time. Aristotle lived before the Common Era, going back even before the times of Chazal in Shas, in the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and he was very influential on the world of ideas going all the way back to the 3rd and 4th centuries before the Common Era, all the way up to this time. So much so that a lot of the writings of Aristotle were adopted by the Catholic Church, by the Christian Church, early on by people like Augustine and Boethius in the Christian Church. And then for some reason, the Christian Church sort of moved away from that, became a little bit more fundamentalized. And for some reason, the Islamic world began to adopt many of these ideas, integrating certain philosophical principles within the Islamic faith. Now, the Muslims even had a word for this kind of dialectical analysis of religious ideas using the philosophical method. They called it kalam. And kalam is an Arabic word which simply means wise speech or wise words. And this type of dialectical method of analysis of religious ideas was popularized by Muslims, and it was adopted by Reb Sadia Gaon in trying to explain principles of Judaism using a very analytical, dialectical method of philosophical reasoning. So this is the world of ideas that we are finding ourselves in when we come to the 12th century and we meet Rebbe Yehuda Halevi. Here he is in a world that is enlightened. Here he is in a world that is extremely tolerant and accepting of the Jewish people, of course, to a certain degree. But he has a challenge. And we can only assume that from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's perspective, Judaism may have been taking a little bit of a beating. What I mean by that is that here's the dilemma. You are part of a parent culture, a parent society, where even the religious community has sort of moved beyond what they perceive to be the primitive components of their faith. And here are the Jews who are still stuck in their Chamisha Chumshei Torah, in their Shas, and in their Poskim, and in their study of Midrash, and they haven't been, so to speak, quote-unquote, enlightened yet by the wonderful world of philosophy. So in this period of time, you have great Islamic religious leaders studying the works of Aristotle through a prism of great Islamic writers, such as Al-Kindi and Al-Farabi and Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd or Averroes, all of these great thinkers which are quite, you know, famous. If you go to a university and you study medieval philosophy, you'll get all of these names. These are the torchbearers of Aristotelian philosophy. Later on, Amir Tzashem, when we go through this 6-week program, the last of our discussion is going to be about another school of philosophy that was incorporated within Aristotelian thought called Neoplatonism. And that is something that we will bring to light momentarily to try and understand exactly how religion is being viewed. And it will be very helpful for us to understand as well Maimonidean thought, how the Rambam looked at the world through his own prism as well, which is the same very, very philosophical prism, which comes out in his work, the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed. Okay. Why is Greek philosophy a threat? We look at science today, we look at philosophy today. Philosophy is a subject that you study in the university. No one today would say that religion is perhaps threatened by philosophy, nor would anyone suggest that science presents a great threat to religion, because the two bodies of thought, or the two bodies of study, really address two different needs within the human being. Science presents facts, and religion provides meaning in life. But what if I were to tell you that philosophy can also provide you with a holistic purpose and a holistic meaning in your life? That is what Aristotelian philosophy was all about. And by the way, the word philosophy, the way we use it today, is quite different from what it meant back in the medieval period. Philosophy was a holistic system, which means that it encompassed mathematics, it encompassed science, physics, but it also encompassed metaphysics. And what we mean by metaphysics is an attempt to explain how everything in the cosmos is working and interactive with the world down here. And what I mean by a holistic system, I mean to say that philosophy offers a sense of purpose to you. What is my meaning in life? We don't look at scientific ideas to find meaning in life. We try to find understanding of the world around us. But that's not the kind of scientific thought that's circulating back then. So it's important to understand that for Aristotle, he was providing a message, providing guidance for the human being to find perfection in his life. For Aristotle, the way to find perfection in your life was to hone your intellect and attain as much wisdom as possible. And through the attainment of the ultimate amount of intellect that a person could possibly attain, one attained perfection and immortality. So the key to immortality, the key, what we call the key to heaven or the key to Olam Haba, for an Aristotelian or philosophical thinker, was greater study, greater understanding of the world around me, an understanding of the cosmos, an understanding of the way that the universe functions, until my mind can actually conjoin or attach itself to ultimate wisdom out there in the ether. And when my mind attaches itself to these great ultimate ideas and ultimately to a God that is somewhere out there, then even after I die, because my mind has transcended my body, I become immortal. And that, in essence, is a system that was actually redefined by many of these Islamic philosophers of the medieval period. And there is something that that is discussed extensively by the Rambam, by the Maimonides, and by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, as well as many other Jewish philosophical thinkers, the Ralbag and the Ibn Ezra and many others, having to do with conjunction. What I mean by conjunction is that when I can attach my mind to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in some way, to his ultimate essence, then that's how I become immortal. The way that the Islamic philosophers explained it was that there is a system within the universe where God, who is the ultimate cause of everything, is somewhere out there controlling everything. The planet Earth is very, very distant from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the way that we can connect to God is through a series of concentric spheres. And I know this is a very, very foreign idea, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this concept, but through a series of concentric spheres that surround our planet Earth, and the outermost sphere is the most connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when God wanted to present reality with his essence, he does it through an emanation of himself through these various spheres until eventually some aspect of God comes down into this world. Now, for those of you who may be studying a little bit of Hasidus and a little bit of Jewish mysticism, you may be able to relate a little bit to the idea of sfirot, of spheres, which is very much a different way of interpreting what I've just explained to you. And as we'll see later on, there are many similarities between the sefirotic system of the Arizal and of the Zohar, and a Neoplatonic system that I'm describing to you now of a series of emanations from God that eventually makes its way down into this world. How does the human being attach oneself to the Almighty if there's all of these filters and all of these barriers between oneself and God? One can only hope from the philosophical, medieval philosophical point of view, to conjoin one's thoughts and one's ideas to the lowermost sphere, which is known as the active intellect or the active intelligence. This was an angel in the opinion of many of the philosophical thinkers. It's known in Hebrew as Haseichel HaPoel. And so therefore, if you ever run across this idea in the writings of the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, it is the active intellect. It is not something that is from a Jewish source, but it is rather from an Islamic source. It really begins with many of the great Islamic philosophers who are interpreting Aristotelian ideas. So Haseichel HaPoel is this lowermost sphere, it's the intelligence in this lowermost sphere that through a human honing his thoughts and perfecting them attaches oneself to this lowermost sphere, becomes one with the Seichel HaPoel, and therefore becomes immortal. Now, there are two ways that you can react to all of these ideas. If the parent culture and society, you open up the news, you turn on the TV, you go on the internet, and everyone's talking about the active intellect, and everyone's talking about how this is obviously true science, which for us today, we clearly understand that these science has evolved, philosophy has evolved beyond this point. But you're living in the 12th century, and you see this is so patently obvious to the world that this is the way the world works. How do you react to it? You have a totally different system. You have a totally different tradition of what the world is all about, what God expects of me. Intellect, what does that have to do with Yiddishkeit? Okay, so there's a mitzvah of studying the Torah, but what about the entire corpus of mitzvot? Where does that fall into place in this philosophical model where what I do with my life is really not the issue, but rather the way I use my mind is really what it's all about. So how do you react to this kind of thing? So I submit to you that there are really two ways to react to this, and this is the way that we find the great thinkers within this medieval period, within this Islamic Spanish world, reacting to this. You have one school of thought, which is the Maimonidean school, which says there is absolutely no stira, there's absolutely no contradiction between modern philosophy and Torah. And not only is there no stira, but all we need to do is adopt some of the terminology of these great philosophical thinkers, incorporate them, these terminologies and these ideas, within our own understanding of the world through our prism of Torah, and we create a hybrid of the two, and this is how we can present Judaism in a beautiful way to the modern man. And that's really the way that the Rambam really tried to do this, and to a certain degree, Reb Sadia Gaon as well. That's not to say that there are absolutely no conflicts between Aristotelianism and Torah. There are a few, and when they do exist, the Rambam will point them out, and he'll tell us there are certain things that we cannot accept. For example, the Aristotelian view is that the world was never created, but it has existed eternally. And Aristotle was able to demonstrate this through a series of proofs and through a series of arguments. And unfortunately, while he may be right about most other things, we cannot accept that. So the Rambam is very clear, and he says, we'll accept most of what he writes, except when it falls under the rubric of kfira, of heresy, that we have to reject. But he got almost everything okay. He got almost everything right. That's one way of approaching it. The other way of approaching it is what I would call the Halevian approach. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lives, as I mentioned, in the 12th century. He's a very enlightened Jew. He's born in the city of Toledo. He migrates to different cities within Spain, studying in the great Torah centers of Cordoba as well. And he comes to a conclusion in his own life that, and by the way, there's a progression or an evolution of his thought over the course of many years when he's writing the Kuzari, that ultimately philosophy is not going to provide you with greater meaning in your life. If anything, it's only going to provide you with a greater sense of confusion. And therefore, while it may sound very sophisticated, and it may present itself as having all of the answers, the reality is that never should the Torah Jew buckle or bend or try to realign his own understanding of reality based upon what society or the parent culture tells him to do. This is one of the reasons why Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's Kuzari is so beloved to Jews for generations. And the reason is because no matter how much of a battering Klal Yisrael has taken in the arena of ideas throughout the centuries, you'll open up the Sefer Kuzari, and he tells you, I am proud to be a Jew, I have nothing to apologize for, there is absolutely nothing primitive about the way of Torah, and if anything, we have provided the light and the truth to the world instead of the other way around. So this is the great Jewish pride of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, which makes it such a beloved Sefer. There's one other very important dialectic or sort of division of schools that we have to draw here. As I mentioned to you before, in the world of Aristotelian philosophy, it is the intellect which is the most important component of the human being. And as such, the way that you think and what goes through your mind is of paramount importance if you wish to gain immortality. Now, if you recall, I mentioned to you that the Rambam was very much a proponent of this kind of view of what brings a person to ultimate perfection. It's not clear, now everyone understands that the Rambam was a great proponent of the observance of mitzvahs. He wrote a set of books called Mishneh Torah, which explains how a Jew has to be an observant Jew, and there's no compromising one's observance for the Rambam. His codification of Jewish law is the paradigm that will exist throughout the ages. But at the same time, in his Mishnah commentary and in his Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, he clearly acknowledges that if a person wants to attain perfection, it is the way that he thinks, which is as important to his future immortality as his observance of the mitzvahs. For the Rambam, therefore, a codification of ideas is equally important to a codification of one's behavior. And therefore would not be surprising if we were to find that the Rambam codifies what are necessary beliefs that a Jew must maintain. And it's for this reason in his Mishnah commentary, and as well as in some places in his Mishnah Torah, that the Rambam actually tells us these are things that a Jew must believe, and if you don't believe these things, you forfeit your share in the world to come. And you and I know them by their more popular terminology as the Shalosha Asar Ikarim, the 13 principles of faith, which are codified by the Rambam. Now, we have these codified in a number of different forms. They appear in the Mishnah commentary to the last chapter of Tractate Sanhedrin. They appear in the back of the Siddur in an abridged form. And we actually also recite them in our prayer service when we say the Yigdal. The Yigdal prayer has 13 lines, each line corresponding to another one of the Rambam's Shlosha Asar Ikar. So no one is disputing that the principles of faith of the Rambam are good and correct and something that we all subscribe to. However, if you are a Halevian, you look at the Torah and you say to yourself, this whole concept of the intellect being of paramount importance, and in order to attain perfection, I must hone my intellect and subscribe to a certain set of beliefs, is of less importance, because the Torah doesn't tell you that there are 13 principles of faith. As a matter of fact, Chazal don't even tell you that there are 13 principles of faith. It's a bit of a mystery, to be quite honest, where the Rambam got this number 13 from. There's a lot of speculation, but there's no clear answer on that. But one thing is clear, that if you are a Halevian thinker, who is not as interested in the attainment of immortality through one's thought, then the codification of ideas is not as vital. And therefore, the emphasis of one's life is no longer revolving around ikarim, of principles of faith, but rather principles of behavior. And there are 613 of them, which are the mitzvahs that we do. So I want you to bear that in mind, that there's going to be a give and take here in this dialectic between the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. If you are a Maimonidean, then you need to subscribe to principles of faith, because it's your intellect that has such an importance in the way that you reach your connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. For Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, if rationalism or one's intellect is not what brings me immortality, and it's through the Maisa HaMitzvahs, that is through the performance of bodily commandments, then there has to be something intrinsically very, very special, what we would call holy or metaphysical, within the things that I do. If it's not a rational approach to intellect and understanding, and it's rather through shaking a lulav or through blowing a shofar or through lighting Hanukkah candles, then there has to be some quality that is not visible to me on a rational level. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, if we wanted to describe him as such, is the counterpart to the Rambam's rationalism. The Rambam is the rational thinker, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is not irrational, don't get me wrong, but he's the non-rational thinker, which means that he looks at the observance of God's commandments as a way of transcending the rational physical world and finding something metaphysical, something mystical within the physical mitzvahs that God wants me to do. So here too you have, and that's one of the reasons why we call this Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the antecedents to Hasidic or mystical thought, is that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi finds a certain metaphysical value in all of the things that I do in my Maisa HaMitzvahs. Let me tell you, we'll take a little pause about all of this philosophical stuff, and I'll just tell you a little bit about the life of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and that will also help shape further some of the ideas that we're going to be presenting over the course of our discussion. We don't know too much about his life. We do know that he was very involved with what we would call the secular world. He was a physician, he was a politician, and he was a great poet. He was a master of the Arabic language and a master of poetry, even though most of his poetry was written in Lashon HaKodesh, in Hebrew. Nevertheless, the Kuzari itself, by the way, was written in Arabic, and it's been translated many times. The first translation came from, I'm drawing a blank, you'll forgive me, but it was translated about 30 years after he wrote the Kuzari from Rabbi Yehuda ibn Tibbon, from Arabic into Hebrew. And that's what that was the primary source of our translation for Feldheim, was the Hebrew edition. Little story about Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, with the little that we know. And actually, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about his life when we analyze Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's sort of interaction with Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra next week, and we talk about sort of the dialectic that existed between the Ibn Ezra and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in a very similar way between the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. So I think, without giving you away too many details, I'll just tell you that he was married and he had one daughter, and his daughter got married under very, very unusual circumstances, according to legend, the legend of which I will share with you next week. But what I will tell you is that towards the end of his life, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi emigrated to Eretz Yisrael. And the reason why he did so is in some ways revealed in Sefer HaKuzari. Because at the very end of the book, we find that there are two protagonists, that there are two characters that are depicted in this very important work. The Kuzari is a dialogue. It is written in a form that was very much popularized back in the medieval period, of when you wanted to present ideas, you put them in the form of a dialogue. That was part of the Socratic method of presenting ideas. Plato did it as well, and it was adopted by many medieval thinkers. You had this setup between two people who were debating each other, and that's how you eventually, you caused one of the characters to emerge as the victorious thinker who was able to prevail upon the other in trying to prove his point of view. The Kuzari begins with a king. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says that there once was a king of a great nation called the Khazars. And that's where we get the name Kuzari from. Who were these Khazars and where did they come from? So before I tell you the story about Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's life, I need to rewind a little bit and tell you the story about what goes on about two centuries before Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. In Spain, in the first few decades of when Jews are now living a life of plenty and religious tolerance in Spain, there is the royal vizier to the caliph, whose name is Chasdai ibn Shaprut. He was a great Jewish leader, a politician, and he's quite very well known in historical circles. He hears through his diplomatic ties that there is a nation that lives somewhere far to the east between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, which, if you know your geography, is somewhere now where southwestern Russia is, and by Georgia and Azerbaijan and Armenia. And there's this huge empire known as the Khazars. People don't know too much about them, but one thing that he hears about this people which piques his interest is that they're all Jewish. And how could that be? How could that be that there's a whole population of Jews that is totally disconnected with the rest of the Jewish world? Who are they and what are they all about? So Ibn Shaprut feels that he has to find out, and because he's very influential in government, he finally finds a set of emissaries who can go and discover more about the Khazars. So he sends two messengers and he sends a letter to the king, and he discovers that the king's name is King Joseph, King Yosef, and he says, I want to find out more about who you are and where you come from. Tell us, what do you know? Are you one of the 12 lost tribes? Can you tell us a little bit about, or one of the 10 lost tribes, can you tell us about some of the things that we may have lost in our Misora through the diaspora period? Do you know when the Messiah is coming? What can you tell us about the set of halacha that you have in your possession? Please share with us your ideas. We don't know how long the response took, but we do know that King Joseph did respond to the correspondence. The reason we know this is because we have that set of letters. They're known as the Chizdai or the Chasdai letters. They were in the museum in St. Petersburg, and they've been copied many times since. And what essentially comes back from King Joseph is, we are not one of the 10 lost tribes. Let me tell you our story. We are a nation of converts, and our conversion took place about two centuries ago, and here's our story. A couple of hundred years ago, we were a nation of pagans, and our king's name was Bulan. And Bulan was a righteous king, a righteous man. And one night, he had a dream. And in his dream, an angel came to him and told him, "Your intentions are desirable to your creator, but not your deeds." And by the way, the version of the story that I'm telling you is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's retelling of the story that's from the Chasdai letters. I don't have time to go into an analysis of the difference between the original version of the story and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's sort of retelling of the story. But I'll touch on it a little bit. Your intentions are desirable to your creator, but not your deeds. So Bulan is confused, he doesn't know what to do, so he goes and he worships in his shrines, in his pagan shrines, more and more and more, to see hopefully that will mollify the angel that visits him in the dream. But the more he goes to the shrines, every night he's visited by the angel in this recurring dream, your intentions are desirable to your creator, but not your deeds, you're not doing the right thing. So this prompts King Bulan to seek out different leaders of religions throughout the world. And in the Chasdai Ibn Shaprut version of the story, which is the origin of this story, he summons three great religious thinkers and a priest, a qadi, which is an Islamic judge, and a rabbi. And he has them present their views on their faith and to argue and have disputations over the course of several days, and to whichever one would sway the king the most, that is the religion that he would choose. As a result, over the course of a number of days or weeks, we don't know how long it took, the king is finally swayed by the Jewish faith because it seems to be the foundational faith for both Christianity and Islam, and he decides to go ahead and he chooses Judaism. Now, in the Halevian version of the story, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi alters the story in a number of different ways. The most significant alteration that he makes in this story is that he adds a fourth cleric to the roster of clerics that come and have their disputation before the king. And anyone know who that is? It's the philosopher. It's the Greek philosopher who is presented as one of the four voices. And in the course of this discussion, the way that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi portrays it in the Kuzari, in the very beginning of the Kuzari, the philosopher says to the king, "You need not concern yourself with one specific set of dogma and one specific set of behavior, because that's not really what counts in life. What you do with your life is not as important as the way that you think, because the key to perfection and immortality is conjunction with the active intellect, the Seichel HaPoel. And as long as you can gather enough information and ideas about reality and about truth, that's really what it's all about. Deeds are good, because if you eat too much, you won't be able to think properly. And if you're coarse and rough and mean to people and you haven't perfected your midot, you don't have derech eretz, you don't have proper, you don't comport yourself in an ethical fashion, you won't be able to work your mind as effectively. But it's only a means to an end, it's not an end unto itself." Well, in the way that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi portrays the story, the philosopher is rejected out of hand by King Bulan. And what's the reason? And this really goes to the core of why did Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in trying to present his worldview in a book of Jewish philosophy and theology, why did he choose the story of the Khazars as his backdrop, as sort of like his stage, as his theater? And the answer is because the angel came to me in a dream and told me, it's not what you... It's not your intention, it's not what your thoughts are that count, it's what you do with your life that counts. And if you're telling me just the opposite, that it's not so much what I do, but what I think, well, that's not what the angel told me, the exact opposite. And so therefore you cannot be preaching the truth, and I have to therefore reject you out of hand. Now, this is really setting the stage for the entire Sefer HaKuzari, and that's precisely why Rabbi Yehuda Halevi chooses this. Now, towards the end of his life, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi emigrated to Eretz Yisrael, as I mentioned to you. Why is the land of Israel so important for him? Well, it has to do with his worldview. So let me start from the beginning and try to create this construct for you of where he's going. Once I understand that it's what I do with my life, that it's the physical objects of this world that I use as my tools in my service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that counts more than the ethereal thoughts of my mind, then I have to objectify all of the physical things in this world that are my tools and my weapons in my service of God. And therefore, everything in this world, every physical object in this world has a value, has sort of like a quantifiable value to it in the way that it's going to help me do mitzvot. And therefore, it's not that every place on the world is exactly the same. No, there's got to be one place in the world which inherently possesses a special quality, that metaphysical quality that I addressed before. And if there is one place in the world which is more special than all other places in the world, it's clearly Eretz Yisrael. It's clearly the land of Israel. And when we talk about specialness that inheres within places, we also need to talk about specialness that inheres within people. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has to quantify that it's not just that all people are the same. There's a hierarchy of people. And that's what causes Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi at the very beginning of his Sefer to say, in one of the most controversial assertions within Judaism, that there's something that defines us as the chosen people. We are known as the chosen people, but what chosenness means is the subject of a tremendous amount of discussion, I should say, within the great medieval thinkers. For the Rambam, chosenness may be nothing more than the fact that we were given a Torah. And I don't want to reveal too much about that, because that's really next week's discussion about this dialectic between the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi about what it means to be the chosen people. But you can understand that if there needs to be an objectification and a concretizing of the physical and each thing's metaphysical value, then there clearly is a metaphysical difference between, an inherent difference between the Jew and the non-Jew as well. We also have to suggest that there is a difference in everything that exists, in language. So therefore, when we talk about Lashon HaKodesh, it's not just a holy language because the Torah is given in this language, but rather there's something that inheres in Ivrit, something that inheres within the Hebrew tongue, which makes it superior on a metaphysical level. And that is why the Hebrew language needs to be used. And I'll touch on that a little bit more as we move on as well. So this emphasis on the very concretized structure of the physical world leads Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi to a very important analogy that he gets into early on in the Sefer. So does everyone understand in his life the reason why he needs to emigrate to Eretz Yisrael? Because Eretz Yisrael ontologically, inherently, has certain specialness to it, has certain kedusha to it that nowhere else in the world has. And if a person wants to achieve the prophetic experience, which for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is the ultimate, he can only achieve that in Eretz Yisrael. For Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the prophetic experience is far more important than the philosophical experience, because the prophetic experience is the experience, the visceral experience, the physical almost experience of God, a face-to-face encounter that is not dependent upon one's intellectual proficiency and acumen, but rather based on revelatory supernatural experience. This too is this part of this dialectic between the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. For the Rambam, the prophetic experience is in itself defined in intellectual terms. So if one looks in Hilchas Deis and wants to learn about how, for the Rambam, you achieve nevuah, it is much more defined in intellectual perfection than it is for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, who defines nevuah as an act of piety and an act of holiness more than an act of intellectual perfection. Okay. But this emphasis on objectification of the physical world leads Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi to provide a beautiful mashal. He says, the only way to attachment and connection to God, the only pathway, is through the Ma'aseh HaMitzvot, is through the performance of the Torah and its commandments. There can be no other way, because sometimes the ideas of the Torah transcend mortal understanding, and if a person were to use his intellect alone, it would take him down labyrinths and pathways that would eventually result in a dead end. And the analogy that he gives is to a fellow who is unlettered, uneducated, a foolish person who one day stumbles across the medicine cabinet of a very sophisticated physician who has wonderful medicines that can actually heal all these different kinds of illnesses. But because this fellow has just observed the doctor from afar, and he sees him dispensing medication to people who come to his clinic, he figures, what could be so hard? So he decides that he's going to do the same thing as well. So one day when the physician is on vacation, he breaks into the clinic, he opens shop and he says, here I am, open for business. Anyone who wants to come to me can see me and get medication for all that ails them. And so people come from far and wide thinking that this fellow is an educated physician and knows what he's doing. And the fellow just basically gives people different colored pills of whatever he finds in the medicine cabinet. And of course, he ends up healing a small percentage of people, but ultimately ends up killing more people than he ends up helping. So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, this is what people will accomplish if they use their intellect alone. Really, unless you're the great physician in the sky, if you have the divine wisdom of the Almighty, are you capable of clearly understanding why God prescribes the things that he does? It's very interesting that we just recently in Parshas Beshalach that God describes himself, Ki ani Hashem rofe echa, I am the Lord, your doctor, your healer. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes that in a very physical, in a very literal way, and he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu dispenses to us, gives us prescriptions for living. We don't always understand why shaking a lulav and an esrog of all things in the world should create this metaphysical elevation of holiness and of spiritual growth that seems to defy logic and understanding. Or any other physical mitzvah, putting on a pair of tefillin, or sitting in a sukkah, or lighting Shabbos candles. Why all of these things have the spiritual elevation that they offer? It seems to defy logic. It seems to defy the intellectual process. But he says that's precisely because we're not the doctor. We don't understand how things work in the universe. There are physical things that contain power. And that really addresses where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going, which is the precision of mitzvahs. There's a very, very difficult passage, and the number of difficult passages in the Moreh Nevuchim and the Guide for the Perplexed. But for the Rambam, it's very important to understand that the Rambam was a stickler for precision and observance of mitzvahs. That's why he wrote the Mishnah Torah. While at the same time being a stickler for specific observance and for precise observance of all of the Torah and its commandments, it's important to understand that on a philosophical level, he may have had a different view for why the Torah's mitzvahs are so precise in the way that they are given. The Rambam cites a midrash, which at face value seems very jarring. The midrash says, why did God tell us that when we slaughter an animal, we should slaughter from the bottom of the neck and not from the nape, not from the back of the head? Why from the front and not from the back? Do you really think, says the midrash, that God really cares whether you slaughter from the bottom or from the top, from the front of the animal's body versus the back of the animal's body? Rather, says the Midrash, God gave us the mitzvahs to perfect us, but it really doesn't make a difference. It's for our sake that God gives us the mitzvahs, not for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's sake. The way that the Rambam understands that Midrash is that he says, really, God wants us to observe commandments so that we worship him, so that we conform to his will. And the very act of conforming to God's will is what brings us closer to him. But were you to try and analyze what are the specific reasons for shechita in the front of the body versus the back of the body, that may be an exercise in futility. Because from God's perspective, it really doesn't make a difference, but God had to have a uniform system in place. He had to decide, listen, Chaver, it's got to be one way. So the one way that I'm going to tell you is the front of the front and not the back of the neck. But that's not the way that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi looks at it. Look, if we're looking at the analogy of the great physician with his great wisdom that transcends human knowledge, and we understand that there's a great precision in the mitzvot, so precise that we can compare it to a pharmacy with drugs where even a slight ounce, what, 1 ounce too much, or even a quarter of an ounce too much, even a gram too much of certain medications could kill the patient instead of saving their lives, then we have to understand that there's absolute precision in every single mitzvah that a Jew performs. So there is great purpose and there is great meaning in the slaughter of the animal from the front of the body versus from the back of the body. You see this, again, this is part of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's worldview. What happened to the Khazars? Let's go back to them for just a second. This is really not part of the discussion of the Khuzari, but it certainly makes for an interesting conversation. Do you know that the Khazars are in the news today as we speak? Is anyone aware of that? What's that? There's another new book by a professor named Professor Sand from Tel Aviv University. you must be familiar with that, who wrote a book about, just recently came out and was translated into English, that the Jews, especially Ashkenazic Jews of today, are not descended from Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but rather we are descended from the Khazars. Because of, he tries to trace historical and the antecedents to Ashkenazic Jewry, and this is the conclusion that he comes to. Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, he's not much of a historian and is not much of a professor. He is a good professor of modern European history, but he's not a professor of this period of history, and therefore he's pretty much been disregarded by a number of people who are experts in the field. This theory that Ashkenazic Jewry is not descended from the tribes of Israel was first put forward in the 1970s by an author named Arthur Koestler. He wrote a book called The 13th Tribe, which was the history of the Khazars. It's a fascinating history. It's a fascinating book. Koestler also was not a great man in this academic field of Ashkenazic Jewish history. He was a film producer, but he also was very much involved in doing research about Jewish history, and this is also one of the conclusions that he suggested. We don't really know what happened to the Khazars because they were overrun by a group of people who would eventually form the Russian Empire in the 12th century. They were known as the Rus. By the way, that was hence the name Russia. R-U-S is the Rus. They were actually Vikings that came from Scandinavia, migrated down through Europe into Asia and into this region of the world and basically overran the Khazars. There's a reason why this story that Chasdai ibn Shaprut presented is so important to Jewish history. There is one theory that the story happened as it was presented to Chasdai ibn Shaprut. But there is another theory, one that seems to be quite reasonable when you think about it. The world in the 9th and 10th centuries was pretty much evenly divided between the world of Islam and the world of Christianity. And there was one nation that was sandwiched geographically in between these two great empires. You had the Christian, Holy Christian Empire, Holy Roman Empire to the north and to the west, and you had the Holy Islamic Empire to the south and to the east. And you had this group of savages or pagans known as the Khazars. And they were under siege. There was constantly warring between themselves and their neighbors. And they came to a determination, quite possibly at some point in history, that listen, guys, we have to come make up our minds. We don't, if we want to remain autonomous and we don't want to be absorbed by the parent empires to the north or to the south, we have to find our own national religious identity because religion is what will make us a cohesive people. Christianity's taken, Islam's taken, what's left? So we might as well settle on the third available religion, the monotheistic, sophisticated, advanced, enlightened faith of Judaism. And so some people suggest that the Khazars chose Judaism for political expediency more than a revelation from an angel. We don't know really what the truth is, but we do know one thing is for sure. archaeological evidence that is that has been conducted in the 20th century has demonstrated without a shadow of a doubt that there was a very strong Jewish presence in the area of the Khazars, and it's quite mysterious exactly how it got there. But nevertheless, the conclusion is that this was an empire that had a very strong Jewish presence. There were yeshivot, there were mikvaot, there were batei knesset, there were synagogues. And it's even been suggested that the Magen David, the six-pointed star, which is also a very, very mysterious origin, actually got its start as a Jewish icon through the Khazar people, and that was passed on to the rest of Jewry. Anyway, I hope that this sort of frames where we're going with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. I just want to conclude with just recapping what we've been discussing up until now. We've presented that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is presented in his own world, a parent culture and a parent system of living and of viewing the world in a way that is very foreign to traditional Judaism. He has an option of either embracing it and adopting it and adapting it to Judaism and to Torah, the way many of his contemporaries did, but he has the other option of saying it's not necessary. And as a matter of fact, at the beginning of the fifth essay, which is the final essay of the Khuzari, he says, I don't want you to think that I'm a bumpkin. I don't want you to think that I'm ignorant. I do know philosophy, and I'm going to show you how much I know. So a very large part of the fifth essay is dedicated to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi explicating his understanding, his analysis of Aristotelian thought as presented through the prism of the great medieval Islamic thinkers like Farabi and Avicenna. But at the same time, he says, you don't want to go down that road, because you go down a road that's going to lead you to great confusion. And you'll end up far more confused than when you started if you take that road. Trust me, I've been there, and I know what its pitfalls are and where it could potentially lead you to. It's not going to provide you with enlightenment. It's not going to provide you with answers. It will only provide you with more questions. And therefore, the greatest thing that a Jew can do is follow the Masoret Yisrael, is to follow the tradition of the Jewish people, observe the commandments, embrace the Torah and its study, and you will end up in a far greater place and you will achieve perfection thereby. That's why the Khuzari is considered to be a Jewish classic, which is studied so widely because it has such a basic message of Jewish pride. We're the ones who gave wisdom to the world. Anything that they have that contradicts us is a distortion of what we originally gave them. You want to know where math came from? It came from the Jews. Where did science come from? Where did astronomy come from? It came from the Jews. They all plagiarized from King Solomon's court. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says this. He says, originally, all the wisdom that is possessed in the world from the Babylonians and the Greeks, they got it from us. They all came to Shlomo HaMelech's palace many, many centuries ago. Their great scribes transcribed all that Shlomo HaMelech taught them. They brought it back to their own governments, and they just forgot to give proper attribution. But it really does come from us, and everything that we have doesn't come from our intellects, doesn't come from philosophizing. It comes from the Koach HaNevuah, it comes from great revelation that God gave to us about the realities of the world. We today may not be privy to that kind of prophetic revelation, but as long as we adhere to the Masorah that starts with the great prophets that our ancestors, our Bubbies and our Zadies, then we'll be okay. Any questions? Raymond in the back. I'm going to have to plead the fifth on that one. The question is that can we compare the dialectic between Maimonides and Halevi to the great dialectic that exists in the Renaissance period and in the modern era between the empiricists and the idealists? I think it's a little bit, that would be an oversimplification. And the reason I have to plead the fifth is because I simply don't know enough about that world of more modern philosophy. I'm not educated enough to be able to tell you with authority that it's either the same thing or different, but the little that I do know tells me that it is a very, very different discussion, although there may be some similarities. Okay, Gerard. The Khuzari means the man from Khazar. That's all it means. The Khuzari means the Khazarian person. And he is the king that is described in the book. You know, there are different theories, and I'll just, you know, I don't want to keep you here too long, but there are different theories that cropped up through the centuries as to where Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi got his dialogue from. But what's been pretty much accepted is that he knew the story. He knew that there was this disputation among the great clerics of the world, and he reconstructed in his own mind a dialogue that could have happened, that might have happened, that was for him very convincing, and he just put it in the mouth of the rabbi that was presented before the Khazar king. Yeah, yes. The question is why? What's the point, or what points do we gain by saying that the wisdom of the world came from Solomon's court? If Solomon himself didn't get it from Torah, he got it from some other source of his own personal communication with God. The point that Rabbi Yehuda Levi is trying to raise is that it's prophetic knowledge that provides person with absolute ultimate truth. Shlomo HaMelech derived his knowledge and his wisdom from God. He didn't derive it through his own intellect. And that's, I think, the point that Rabbi Yehuda Levi is trying to put forth. It's a very good question. But what he's putting forth is that Shlomo HaMelech received or achieved chokhmah not through intellectual effort, but rather through piety, rather through his devotion to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not through his intellectual prowess. What? I beg your pardon? Yes. Yes, exactly. It was through his piety, through his observance of the Torah and its mitzvahs, that he was able to attain all of this knowledge. That's exactly the point. Very good. Yeah. Right. That's a very good question. It's a very interesting way of looking at it. The question, just to repeat it, is why does Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi need a reason to go to Eretz Yisrael because it's a holier place, it's closer to God? Why not argue that it's a mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael, and because he's very much into mitzvah observance, that should be his motivation? Well, the reality is that it's very unclear when you look in the poskim whether or not there's a mitzvah chiyuvit, an absolute obligation to live in the land of Israel. It's very difficult for us to make a determination how Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi himself paskened, because Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi didn't write Sifrei Halacha. He didn't write in a halachic format. He wrote in a philosophical format, a theological format. One thing that he writes at the end of the book, and he creates this great debate between himself and the king says, why do you need to go? I want you to stay. You've provided us with so much knowledge and wisdom, and you can serve Hashem just as well here as you can in Eretz Yisrael. And Rabbi Yehuda Levi says it's simply not the same kind of avoda. There's a certain kedusha in the land that allows me to observe the mitzvahs on a much higher level qualitatively than I can when I'm in the diaspora. And that leads us to conclude that Rabbi Yehuda Levi probably did view Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, living in the land of Israel, as a mitzvah, but more of a broad mitzvah that encompasses other mitzvahs under itself, meaning that it's not a mitzvah in and of itself, but it enables me through the holier status of Eretz Yisrael, it enables me in everything that I do and everything and every mitzvah that I do while living in Eretz Yisrael assumes a higher quality of service. So it's a means to a greater observance and a greater closeness with God. Yes, Steve. I'm not aware of any period in Jewish history where the Kuzari was banned or put aside. It's interesting because that's in contradistinction, of course, as you probably know, to the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, where there were at least four different periods in Jewish history where the book was placed under ban and either burned or put into cherem or whatever it is, right? So the Kuzari was never that way. And the reason is because I believe the way I've presented it to you is that it's much more traditional in its outlook. There's no need for us to interpret Judaism through a prism of philosophy. Interpret it the way it is, right? There's no reason to compromise. There's no reason to reinterpret, to change our lexicon. Correct. He does not give that credence to Aristotelian philosophy. He says, I know it. It's not hard to understand. These are the ideas presented herein, and these are the problems that are inherent within Aristotelian thought. But either way, you don't need it. It's not going to make you a better Jew. And there's no reason, therefore, to ban it, because it's not pulling Jews away from tradition. How does the question is, how does the Shalah HaKadosh... Well, it's important to know. I don't know. I have to, again, plead the fifth. I don't know enough about the Shalah HaKadosh's writings in regard to the Rambam. But what I can tell you is that many mystics throughout history have used the Mor Nevuchim in ways that probably the Rambam would not have endorsed. The one that's probably the most famous is Rabbi Avraham Abulafia, who was a great mystic in the 13th century, who lives around the time when the Zohar is being written, just a little bit before then, and uses the Rambam's understanding of conjunction with the active intellect as a mystical experience. I don't think the Rambam would have endorsed that. So it's very possible. I don't know enough about the Shalah HaKadosh and the way that he relates to the Mor Nevuchim, but if he does, it could be that it does it in a way that's different from the way that the Rambam originally intended. I have no indication from his writings that he was a Mekubal. I know that's the subject of much speculation, especially in Hasidic thought. I'll leave that up to Rabbi Wolf to expound on that subject. Anyway, thank you all for coming. We'll see you, Mirz Hashem, next week.
Thank you,
thank you all for coming, and thank you, Rabbi Krupkin, for a fascinating shir. I hope to see you all back next week, Mirz Hashem, on Wednesday night. And again, a good evening and thanks.